This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Naz Campanella. This Monday, charities struggling to get rapid antigen tests for people at risk as supply issues continue to cause difficulties. And love in the time of corona. We hear from a Queensland couple reunited for the first time in a year after being separated due to the pandemic. Now they're looking forward to planning their long-awaited wedding.
I'm 36 years old and I have Down syndrome and I am engaged to my beautiful fiancée, Angelica. I'm not only get saying whether I'm that, but Santa Claus has brought my fiancée to me as a Christmas present.
Well, COVID case numbers and hospitalisations are climbing, even as less people come forward for PCR testing. It means that the proportion of people who have the virus is far higher than what is reflected in official figures, the levels which the World Health Organization classifies as out of control. The question now is, how do we get this latest wave under control in Australia? Catherine Gregory reports.
The soaring demand for PCR testing right now means not everyone with COVID is able to get a test and be captured in the daily figures. And according to some experts, it means the pandemic is officially out of control in many parts of Australia.
WHO have set a cutoff of 5%. And they say that if you have less than 5% test positivity, then everything's under control. Anything greater than that, and things are out of control. So in every state and territory in Australia at the moment, apart from Western Australia, things are basically out of control.
Adrian Esterman is an epidemiologist and biostatistician at the University of South Australia. He's talking about COVID test positivity rates, which refers to how many people are testing positive out of how many people are getting tested. It's estimated to have gone from less than 1% a couple of months ago to around 20% in New South Wales now.
But now, because of the new government guidelines, there's a much smaller group of people going in for testing. And they're far more likely to be positive because they've usually got symptoms or they've been close contacts or they're testing to see if they've recovered. So you have very high test positivity rates. But what it also means is there's a lot of people out there who didn't go in for testing and who are likely to be infectious, probably several times the actual declared case number.
In Victoria, the latest figures show there were more than 8,500 positive cases out of 44,000 tests. Adrian Esterman says since the reproduction number is over 2, it means there's a doubling of case numbers every 4 days. So what will it take to reduce the spread of the virus? Professor Esterman says either stricter public health measures or we just wait it out, which is what he believes governments are aiming for at the moment.
They're hoping that with enough people getting booster shots, because we know that just 2 doses isn't sufficient, that it'll bring case numbers down. And it's not only that, but you're getting these thousands and thousands and thousands of people being infected, especially in New South Wales. They're going to recover and be reasonably immune. So you've got all of this sort of immunity from recovering from infection, plus more and more people getting vaccinated. So eventually that will tend to reduce the case numbers down.
He thinks there could be a tipping point before that, though, where the health systems just can't cope with a sheer number of cases. And he believes New South Wales is already close.
So let's just assume that 5% of people infected have it severe enough they have to go into hospital. So that's 1,000 people a day. No way New South Wales Health could manage that.
Dr. Michael Bonning is a respiratory specialist in Western Sydney and the AMA's New South Wales Chair of Council. He says there's been a huge increase in hospitalisations. In New South Wales, it's now 1,200, rising by the hundreds each day.
That is lower than we would have expected if we were an unvaccinated population or without this Omicron variant, but certainly the higher case rates across the state and across the country do mean we should expect to see increasing rates in hospital. Now, whether that will extend to ICU is a story where, you know, we're still working on, we're still working to understand. But with both the Christmas period and with hospital workers being furloughed due to their close contact status, we're finding that it is becoming quite difficult to staff, especially critical areas of hospitals.
He says healthcare workers have been working in high-pressure settings for 2 years now, and something needs to change. Governments need to invest more in recruiting healthcare staff and in hospitals. But Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt says while hospitalisations have increased, there's also been a drop in the number of people on ventilators.
And as we adapt to Omicron, we're able to better protect Australians. And we're seeing that with the results in the ventilation units. At the moment, there are 51 Australians as of last night who are currently on ventilation for COVID. This is actually down from 54 patients nationwide on the 15th of December. So almost 3 weeks later, there's actually been a reduction in patients on ventilation. So all of these things are coming together to help protect Australians.
And as Professor Sanjaya Senanayakar, an infectious diseases specialist, points out, we're better placed now than we were at the start of the pandemic.
There's some Japanese data that came out suggesting it's, in its early stages, Omicron's 4.2 times more transmissible than Delta. And if that's the case, it's potentially the most infectious disease we've ever seen in human history. So I'm very glad that Omicron has arisen now and not in 2020 when we didn't have any vaccines and we didn't know what medications worked.
ANU's Professor Sanjaya Senanayakar ending that report by Catherine Gregory. Well, frontline services that help the homeless and people fleeing family violence say they're struggling to access rapid antigen tests. It comes as calls grow louder to make rapid antigen tests free, particularly for those receiving social security payments. But the Prime Minister is resisting those calls, saying the government can't pay for everything. Alexia Atwood has more.
Since the start of the pandemic, Reverend Bill Cruz has been fighting for supplies to help people struggling with homelessness. First it was masks, then vaccines, now rapid antigen tests.
That took ages and ages and pushing and pushing. This is just another step in the ladder.
Rapid antigen tests are so crucial for his charity's operations that it has had to burn through a lot of cash to get them.
Oh, I think we spent about $15,000, maybe a bit more, because we have aged volunteers who work with the people who come in. You have to test them every day before they come in, just so they feel safe. And then if we find someone who's not vaccinated or someone who looks sick, then we test them.
With supply under strain, Reverend Cruz says it's getting harder and harder for frontline services like his to get a hold of rapid antigen tests.
Like, honestly, give us the bloody tests.
Peter McNamara is the president of the Australian Council of Social Service and says other frontline services are also struggling to get their hands on the tests.
We need to make sure that we can keep the doors open of those essential services. Prioritise those. I'm not saying we don't need businesses, of course we do, but unless we have those open, where do the homeless go? Where do women escaping family violence go? So there's a real concern I have at the front line, and a lot of the non-for-profits that they're already chasing and spending money to try to buy these tests.
He says they should be free for those on social security payments.
ACOS are extremely concerned that we have nearly 3 million people who are struggling already to live below the poverty line, that are struggling to pay for food, to pay for rent. And within that 3 million, we're talking about almost a million children, you know, surviving on less than $45 a day, or they won't be able to fork up money for a COVID rapid antigen test that may cost them $50 to $70. So we're calling on the federal government to make it freely available for people on social security payments and the frontline community organisations who support them.
President of the National Pharmacy Guild, Trent Toomey, says a lack of adequate planning means importers are struggling to get supplies onto shelves and they're passing the higher importation costs onto consumers.
We have to air freight them. So those importers are, you know, having to pass those air freight charges onto the wholesalers. The wholesalers are then doing their best to rush them out in the backs of vans and trucks on public holidays. So they're passing those extra costs onto the pharmacies. And of course, that extra cost just ends up being burdened and brunted by the consumer.
The federal government is resisting calls to make rapid antigen tests free for all Australians. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has told Channel 7 that some people will be able to access publicly funded tests, and now isn't the time to make them free for everyone.
We've invested hundreds of billions of dollars getting Australia through this crisis, but we're now in a stage of the pandemic where you can't just make everything free, because when someone tells you they want to make something free, someone's always going to pay for it, and it's going to be you.
Richard Holden, Professor of Economics at the University of New South Wales Business School, argues rapid antigen tests should be fully funded by the Commonwealth.
Economists like to distinguish between regular goods, you might call them private goods, and public goods. So, you know, if you buy a coffee, that benefits you. It doesn't directly benefit the people around you. With things like public goods, education, national defence, and rapid antigen tests are a good example. Not only do you get a benefit, but people around you get a benefit. So if you find out that you're positive and you're able to protect yourself, that's good for you, but it's also good for the people around you. And when that happens, the people's private incentive to pay for an antigen test is going to be lower than what we want the social incentive to be. In the language of economics, there's a positive externality. And the way we deal with everything that has positive externalities, like education, is we subsidise it.
How concerned are you that our hospital systems are going to start to be overrun over the next few weeks? And why are rapid antigen tests one tool that could stop that from happening?
The concern is that hospitalisations lag infections by 1 to 2 weeks. We've known that for a long time now. And if you look at the case numbers over the last few days in New South Wales, they're really, really high. So looking at hospitalisations now relative to those case numbers is not the right thing to do. We need to look at them lagged by a week or two. And so the concern is that we're going to see a big spike in hospitalisations and ICU bed usage several days from now. Now, I certainly hope that doesn't happen and it's definitely possible that it won't happen. But I feel like we're not planning at all for the contingency of what if it does happen. Now, rapid antigen tests can really help with that because they provide people with really good information basically instantaneously. So, you know, you're probably not going to go to a holiday barbecue. You're probably not going to go to the shops if you get a rapid antigen test. You know that you're infectious and you don't want to infect other people. So you're going to take measures to stop you infecting other people. And that information would be available to people. Right now, people are flying blind.
Professor Richard Holden from the University of New South Wales, Alexia Atwood reporting there. Well, let's head overseas now, and there are warnings that Afghanistan is facing the biggest humanitarian crisis of our time. More than half of the country's population is facing starvation, and over 3 million children under 5 are expected to suffer from acute malnutrition. The Afghan economy went into a tailspin after the Taliban seized power as donor countries cut assistance. Australian-run grassroots charities are struggling to help those back in Afghanistan and say the world has forgotten about Afghan people. Carly Williams has more.
After escaping the Taliban nearly 20 years ago, Tahira Nasrat has been reliving her trauma since the Taliban took Afghanistan's capital of Kabul in August 2021. Now safe in Sydney, she runs the Australian charity the Afghan Peace Foundation. She spends every day worried about her staff members that are stranded in Afghanistan. A family of 8 has been hiding and living out of a cab.
It's extremely difficult. I have never experienced such a life. 8 people in one taxi, which can only take 5, because they had no other option.
The family is being hunted by the Taliban simply because they work for an international NGO. On Christmas Day, they were found.
The husband was beaten brutally, extremely, like he was almost to death. I had some photos which was really, really emotional and really heartbroken to see the husband and wife, both of them were located, both of them were beaten. In reference to the photos, he was beaten on the head and he was bleeding. The wife or the woman was beaten at the back. The whole body was bruised. The children were crying. They have received a threatened letter from Taliban and that if we find you, we will kill you.
Tahira says she's heartbroken. The international communities have turned their back on Afghanistan. She's calling on the global community to urgently help. The Afghan economy went into a tailspin after the Taliban seized power. Now more than half the country's population is facing starvation. And over 3 million children under 5 are expected to suffer from acute malnutrition. Mahbuba Rawi is an Afghan refugee and now an Australian citizen. Her charity, Mahbuba's Promise, runs orphanages and looks after more than 500 widows in Afghanistan.
There is such a poverty in the country at the moment that there is no word to describe it. Women in particular, there is 3,000 more women coming to receive support from us. because they're not allowed to go to work. So 60% of our population is women, and they all not going to work. So imagine how they're going to feed their family, but especially when they're widows and orphans.
There is still some produce and food coming in from Pakistan, but not everyone can access it.
Last night, there was a very sad news that one teacher died from hunger because he didn't eat for 4 days. So children dying in Afghanistan every day, and people dying from hunger and from poverty, but there is not much news around in Western world, because I don't know why they're putting close eyes to Afghanistan while everyone left. What happened to these poor people?
Mahbuba Rawi warns if the World Bank and big charities don't step up the support, the situation will only get worse.
It's a human disaster. Human disaster. This Afghan people is very, very tough people. They just gone through so much on their life, 50 years of war. And now they're left alone in a position that there is no door for them. There is no justice for the Afghan people.
Afghan-Australian Mahbuba Rawi, ending that report by Carly Williams. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks so much for your company. In theory, Australia's international border is open. Most vaccinated Australians living overseas are now allowed to travel here without having to isolate. Skilled migrants and international students are welcome back too. But the threat of the Omicron variant, uncertainty around domestic borders and cancelled flights means that for many people, 2021 was another year they've been unable to return home. Bridget Fitzgerald prepared this report.
When musician Bree Robertson penned this song in 2020, she couldn't have imagined she'd miss two family Christmases in a row.
Oh my God, absolutely not. I think even last year I was still shocked that I wasn't able to come home for Christmas.
The 31-year-old lives in Berlin with her husband, a long way from her family on Queensland's Sunshine Coast.
To still kind of be in this situation is just unfathomable to me, and it's been the most heartbreaking part of this whole traumatic pandemic event for me and so many other Australians. Horrible.
Quarantine requirements have lifted for most vaccinated Australians, skilled visa holders and international students, but many, like Bree Robertson, have chosen not to travel this summer because they can't afford to take the risk things will change.
Because I'm a freelance artist and because I really can't take off too much time from work and I don't make a lot of money doing what I do anyway, it just hasn't been possible to consider paying exorbitant prices for flights and then also having to dedicate like 2 weeks just to quarantine and to pay for my own quarantine in a hotel. I just do not have the funds for it.
And the uncertainty is being heightened because different states have different rules about international arrivals.
It's the lack of information and the lack of firm dates, the lack of notice when things change.
Perth woman Carissa Garza is originally from Texas.
I would most of all just like to go sit in my parents' house and spend time with my parents, my sister, my brother, my sister-in-law, my niece, and my nephews, most of whom I haven't seen now for 3 years. I would be happy. We would be happy just sitting in their house.
She's desperate to get to the US to see her loved ones and for her 8-year-old daughter to spend time with her family. Her father's been hospitalised twice in 6 months. But she's decided to delay travel because she can't afford to get stranded there if international or state border rules change.
There's no confidence and no peace. You know, it's this constant level of anxiety about what are they going to announce? What are they going to change? What are they going to close off?
As for Bree Robertson, she's trying to be optimistic and will attempt a trip to Australia in March.
After 2 years, like our emotional and mental health is hanging by a thread, And I feel like a disappointment, like a plane trip getting cancelled, it's not only a financial blow, but it would be heartbreaking. Like, my heart breaks for the people who have just been put in quarantine and have to wait longer. It's just, it's so painful. It's so painful.
Berlin musician Bree Robertson ending Bridget Fitzgerald's report. Well, if you've been feeling like there's just too much doom and gloom around lately, I don't blame you, but here's something we all need, a good old-fashioned love story. A Queensland couple have reunited for the first time in a year, having been separated because of the risks associated with the pandemic. They're about to celebrate 10 years of being engaged and hope to mark it by finally being able to plan their long-awaited wedding. It's a story of resilience, strength and romance. Love in the time of corona. Meet David Waldie and his fiancée Angelica Maffey Stump.
Hi, I'm David. I'm 36 years old and I have Down syndrome. And I am engaged to my beautiful fiancée, Angelica.
My name's Angelica and I'm 35 years old.
They're sitting in the living room of David's family home in Brisbane, holding hands tightly and discussing their shared love of music and movies. The pair live with Down syndrome and haven't seen each other for 12 months thanks to lockdowns and isolation. Angelica has travelled from her home in Port Douglas to see in the new year with David. This reunification is a milestone as the couple marks a decade of being engaged.
I think all the stars have aligned for us. And all I kept saying was that I'm Santa Claus has brought my fiancée to me as a Christmas present.
That's so sweet. I love you, sweetheart.
They got engaged at David's mother's 50th birthday party.
I did the old traditional way. I asked her dad to approval to marry my girlfriend Angelica, right?
Yeah, he gave me a fetch ring.
I did get you a fetch ring.
David and Angelica first met more than 30 years ago as babies through their mothers, Mary Waldie and Selena Maffey. The women connected because they had young children with Down syndrome and similar attitudes to supporting people with disability to have a good life. David's mother Mary says their children's connection was instant.
It's a deep love. And it's a resilient love. They've loved each other for a long time and they're best friends.
During the 12 months of COVID separation, they'd talk on the phone and their respective jobs kept them busy. Angelica has worked as a guest services attendant at the Port Douglas Sheraton Grand Mirage for the last 15 years. David is a professional singer, songwriter, actor and dancer. Angelica's mum, Selena Maffey, is proud of how much they've grown together.
Since that time, it's really been a very true, deep, supportive relationship which they've navigated, but also with us listening to them and finding out what's important to them. And there's been lots of learning for all of us.
And she says she looks forward to the day when their wedding will finally take place.
I think that as they have been and in their own time, they will know. And what we need to do, and just listening to these two beautiful people. And I guess we're just going to continue to sidestep to COVID in one way or another. I think we're going to have a fabulous celebration sooner or later.
And when that day finally does come, David and Angelica know it would have been worth the wait.
I reckon it's good for people to know that they don't have to rush into marriage. And it's also important for us to build up independence and skills has also been so very important. But also, the real most important thing is that we always loved each other since this day dot. If we had a song to describe our relationship, it would be Ed Sheeran's Perfect.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Not all doom and gloom. What a beautiful way to end today's show. That was David Waldie and before that, his fiancée, Angelica Maffey Stump, ending that report. And that's all from the World Today team for this Monday. David Lipson and the PM team will be along this evening with you and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow with more stories from across Australia and the world. Thanks so much for your company today. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm Naz Campanella. Have a safe and wonderful afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.